Welcome, everyone. I'm Marilyn Stern, Middle East Forum Board Member, serving as Chair. Today we'll be hearing from Professor Joshua Teitelbaum, an Israeli scholar and expert on Persian Gulf states, a senior research associate at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies, and professor of Middle East Studies at Bar-Ilan University. Professor Teitelbaum will brief us on the background and consequences of last month's Saudi execution of a jailed Shiite leader. Professor Teitelbaum?
Oh, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm an avid reader, and I've contributed to the Middle East Quarterly, and I enjoy the work the Middle East Forum does, and Dan Pipes is a friend of mine as well. I'll just start by reminding us that just over a month ago, the Saudi authorities executed a Shiite leader, Sheikh Nimr Bakr al-Nimr. He was a popular Shiite leader, and he had been arrested in 2012. They also executed, by the way, 46 other political opponents, mostly Sunni political opponents, and actually people who had been engaged in violence in what is known as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So this started a sequence of events leading to an increase in tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The Saudi embassy in Tehran was sacked. Iranian leaders and Lebanese Hezbollah leaders promised God's revenge. Saudi Arabia, followed by Bahrain, Sudan, the UAE, broke off diplomatic relations with Iran. I think some other countries as well have done so. And this kind of thrust the whole Shiite, particularly the Saudi Shiite issue, into the news. But it's not a new issue, the issue of Shiites in Saudi Arabia, nor are the tensions with Iran a new issue as well. I'm a historian by profession, and I'm very aware, and I would like to share with you the place the Saudi Shiites have had in Saudi Arabia. It's really a very old issue, and it goes to the essence, to the very raison d'etat of Saudi Arabia as the paragon of Sunni Islam. So first, some basic facts, and I have some things I want to share with you, and I'm sure I won't be able to cover everything, so whatever I don't cover here, hopefully we'll be able to cover in the Q&A. Just some basic facts to start with. We don't really have an exact number of Saudi Shiites. The Saudis don't publish a census, but they constitute between 10 and 15% of the population, and they're about 33% of the population in the eastern province. This is where Saudi Arabia's oil is located, and so that makes it important as well. There's also a small number living in Medina, near Mecca, in the western part of Saudi Arabia. Now, the Shiites of Saudi Arabia have had the misfortune to have their fate always determined by outside forces, whether they be the Saudis or the Iranians. And the Saudis and the Iranians, and the Saudis and the Shiites, have a long history of enmity, punctuated with periods of good relations. Saudi Arabia's Shiites have often found themselves caught in the middle. They've been both the object of Saudi persecution and disdain, and the subject of Iranian recruitment to subvert the Saudi regime. And historically, their response has moved between dissimulation, accommodation, attempted reconciliation, and terrorism. They reject the official narrative of Saudi history, which portrays the capture of the area where most of the Shiites live, the eastern province, as kind of a unification of the Arabian Peninsula. They consider the capture of that territory in 1913 as an occupation. Deep in Shiite historical memory rests their persecution by the Saudis during the 18th and 19th centuries. Famously, the Saudis expanded into Iraq in the early 19th century. Saudi warriors destroyed the tomb of Imam Hussein in Karbala and the tombs of the Prophet's companions in Mecca and Medina, all of which demonstrated the extreme enmity the Saudi Wahhabis held towards the Shiites. For the Wahhabis, a bit of theology here I need to share with you. For the Wahhabis, grave worship is the paramount act of polytheism. This is a severe accusation from which the Shiites constantly suffered. If I was going to make a very general comparison, Wahhabism is extremely monotheist. They don't allow grave worship. They don't allow saint worship or intercession between man and God. They consider this a kind of a heretical idea. So the government, the Saudi government, its base of support is among the Wahhabi anti-Shiite majority. It's a religious state, and it derives its legitimacy from this form of Islam, Wahhabism, that is almost by definition anti-Shiite. And there's really a long history of Wahhabi anti-Shiite polemics. The Wahhabi majority expects the Saudis, as the leader of the Sunni world, to put the Shiites, led by Iran, in their place. The government is therefore loath to be seen as trying to placate its own Shiites or Iran. So there are two important political elements that constantly impact on the fate of Saudi Shiites. One is internal, the Wahhabi clerics and their rank-and-file followers, and the legitimacy of the Saudi family, the legitimacy that the Saudi family seeks from these clerics and supporters. And the other is external, Iran, Saudi Arabia's main political and religious rival across the Gulf. So this ideology, this fanatic Wahhabi ideology, has served the regime for about two centuries in mobilizing various tribal groups and casting the Shiites in the role of the quintessential other, Muslims who were worse than Jews or Christians. To Sunnis in general, the Shiites are ones who rejected the first three rightly guided caliphs. But for the Wahhabis, they're even worse than that, something I've already alluded to. They are polytheists. They associate people, such as the imams and the prophet's family, with God. And many Shiite beliefs and practices stand in sharp contradistinction to the Wahhabi creed, with its strong emphasis on the unity of God. And most importantly, the Saudi religious family is religiously based. It's based on this uncompromising monotheism, this anti-Shiism. The raison d'etre of the state is to be an Islamic state, an Islamic Sunni Wahhabi state. So basically, throughout their history, the Shiites have paid the price of the Saudi royal family's quest for religious legitimacy. Now, to skip nearly to the present very quickly, in the so-called Arab Spring of 2011 to 2012, there were constant demonstrations by Shiites in the eastern province. In fact, the only Arab Spring-like activity at all in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was in the eastern province. This was originally meant in support of the Shiite uprising in neighboring Bahrain. These demonstrations sometimes became violent, and they were met with violence, and they quickly developed a life of their own. Many were killed or arrested. The Saudis had an iron fist policy. They're not interested in political or religious reform. And even today, there are demonstrations every week in the eastern province. So in the face of the challenge of the Arab Spring, the Saudi government played the sectarian card. It tried to scare Sunni oppositionists by inflaming Shiite protests. There was press campaigns against the Shiites. There were anti-Shiite mosque speeches. And this fell in as a part of the counter-revolutionary rhetoric of the Saudi regime. Now, this particular sheikh who was executed, he had in the past been associated with some violent movements, but he had not called for violence, not really openly called for violence. He did have some very harsh things to say about the regime. He called for people to be martyrs if necessary. And the Saudi Minister of Interior died in 2012, he called for worms to eat his body. Okay, you just don't say those kind of things in Saudi Arabia about members of the royal family. It's not done. When he was finally arrested, he was shot in the leg. He was thrown in the back of a patrol car. And this was captured on video, and it went viral, and this inflamed passions quite seriously. Now, when these protests erupted in Bahrain, these were very serious, and the Saudis actually went into Bahrain to put the protests down. Bahrain, as some of you may know, is run by a Sunni royal family, and which rules a Shiite majority. And they're really the Shiites of the Eastern Province in Saudi Arabia consider the Shiites of Bahrain their brethren, and this inflamed a lot of passions. But for the Saudis look at Bahrain. I think the best comparison is to say that they look at Bahrain a bit like the United States looks at Puerto Rico, not exactly a part of the country, but nearly a part of the country, and they've threatened to actually annex Bahrain if the royal family there is in danger. Also remember that a year ago we had a change of leadership in Saudi Arabia, just over a year ago. And King Salman and his son, Deputy Crown Prince, and Minister of Defense Mohammed bin Salman have taken Saudi Arabia on a new path of international assertiveness, and this involves a much more muscular foreign policy. Now, politics abhors a vacuum, and the Saudis feel abandoned by the Obama administration. They basically feel that the Obama administration has made a pivot to Iran. In the zero-sum game of Middle Eastern politics, Washington's policy is seen as pro-Iranian and pro-Shiite. With Iran ready to go nuclear, perhaps delayed, but having the capability to do so, with Iraq already a Shiite state, with Saudi Arabia's Syrian foe appearing to gain the upper hand, with Iranian-supported Houthis in the south and ISIS all over the place, including Saudi Arabia, King Salman has embarked on a more vigorous path. He intends to confront Iran and ISIS, as well as the less formidable Al-Qaeda. And he let Iran know this by executing its supporter, Nimr al-Nimr. So again, Saudi Shiites have paid the price for regional rivalries and Saudi anti-Shiism. Whenever the Saudi regime seeks to bolster its Sunni credentials, it is paid for this with Shiite coin. So this kind of demonstrates the connection between what may be a local issue, say its relations with its Shiite subjects, to the larger issue of relations with Iran and even relations with the United States. Let's, of course, not forget that in October 2011, there was an assassination attempt by Iranian agents on the Saudi ambassador to Washington. That ambassador is Adel Zubair. He's now the foreign ministry, and he's leading the charge against Iran. So I'll just conclude. I think I had about 15 minutes. I'll just say one more thing. This is not a problem that's going to go away. The Saudis feel, it's very clear, quite abandoned by Washington. The Obama administration has made it clear in public statements and in private statements that it seeks a balance in the Middle East, that no longer to support the Saudi ally, but to raise up Iran to have a kind of a balance of power in the region. The Saudis see this, of course, as an entirely pro-Iranian policy. This is, of course, creating a lot of insecurity in Riyadh. The main point here is that they will continue to fill the vacuum left by the U.S. retrenchment. And if in previous years they waited for the United States to take the lead, now, to the best of their ability, will take their own initiative. Okay. I think we can begin the Q&A.
Thank you. The question and answer period will now begin, and we invite your participation. Please note that when there are no questions in the queue, the moderator will ask a question. To join the question and answer session queue, just press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to identify yourself when your line has been unmuted, please do so. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. So once again, to join the question and answer session queue, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And we'll take our first question now. If you wish to identify yourself, please do so.
Yes, this is Larry Holland, and my question is, why hasn't there been, in your opinion, more overt hostility from Iran to Saudi Arabia in the form of, you know, them having one of their proxies lob, you know, missiles into any of their petrochemical complexes or oil fields that would have a, you know, pretty major impact with, you know, deniability of the Iranians through, you know, one of their proxies?
Well, I think even in Iran, they would consider that an extreme response. Iran itself is pretty bogged down now in Iraq and in fighting ISIS, and they probably don't see it in their interest to open another front with Saudi Arabia. There is a kind of a balance of threat there. Saudi Arabia would respond itself, and the U.S. would probably respond as well. So I don't think that's a step that the Iran wants to take now.
Ellen, do we have another question in the queue?
No, not at this time.
Okay, I will ask one. Josh, can you please comment on the significance of Pakistan, which is a nuclear state, aligning with Saudi Arabia?
Sure. The Saudi relationship with Pakistan is a bit complex. It's widely believed that Saudi Arabia bankrolled the Pakistani nuclear program. And that if it wanted, it could get a nuclear weapon off the shelf. I mean, this is not kind of, not really, you know, proven anywhere, but it's widely believed, even in unpublished documents, that that's the case. excuse me. But the Pakistanis have helped out. They have occasionally sent some troops. I believe there were some Pakistani troops in Bahrain. But they are very careful about sending their troops overseas. And you may remember, it was the end of December or early January, the Saudis announced a 35-member anti-terrorism coalition, military coalition, which included such military powers such as the Comoros Islands. I'm being a bit facetious. And including Pakistan. And Pakistan immediately said, well, you know, we don't really know anything about this, okay? They may have been taken by surprise. But on the other hand, Saudi officials have been visiting there, and I'm sure they're working out some kind of agreement, some kind of understanding, but it's difficult to see where it's going. And we certainly don't see Saudi Arabia. Pakistan also has relations with Iran. We certainly don't see, excuse me, Pakistan kind of jumping on the anti-Iran bandwagon and putting itself fully in the Saudi court.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take our next question now. Please go ahead when your line is unmuted.
Hello, am I on the air?
Yes, Yes, go ahead.
I hear you.
Oh, Professor Teitelbaum, thank you. That was most enlightening. And perhaps you mean to stay within the Saudi and Iranian sphere of discussion. And this is out of bounds, but I'm wondering how this ties in with the majority of the 9/11 bombers being from Saudi Arabia and their influence in Harvard bringing so much money to influence the textbooks in America.
Sure. You bring up a kind of a paradox. So for years, the Saudis really did support the export of their brand of extremist Islam overseas. They supported the Afghani Mujahideen, who were Islamic extremists, by the way, also supported by the United States, to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. This is a way of kind of exporting their own anti-regime problems and kind of letting people have their head and go overseas and spread, both fight and spread, and give money to extremist mosques and so forth. But 9/11 was a wake-up call to the Saudis. And since 9/11, they have really drawn back their support of these extremist groups overseas. Some private citizens still contribute to these groups, but the government is very much involved now in fighting terrorism. But, you know, they're fighting terrorism when it gets to the point of armed activity. They still tend to sympathize with and support the ideology that if it's taken far enough will lead to terrorism. So that's the paradox. They're very helpful, though, in intelligence cooperation and in fighting extremism. I mean, there's no country really who has more to lose from ISIS winning than Saudi Arabia, and ISIS is already carrying out attacks in Saudi Arabia. So in a way, you can kind of look at it as, in Hebrew there's an expression that I can't think of it in English right now, that it's kind of like a Frankenstein-like effect, I guess, that they created a monster and now they have trouble putting it back in the box, but they are trying to put it back in the box.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you for your question. And we'll take our next question now. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Bob Lewitt. And I have a question about the survivability of the Saudi government. The price of oil has declined considerably. Their population is very dependent on being placated by the financial resources generated by high oil prices. What is going to be the impact on the benefits to the population, and what you anticipate their response will be if this oil price decline continues for the next year?
Sure. Great question. But if I had, a dollar for every time people have talked about the regime collapsing, I would be a very wealthy man by now. Oil has gone up and gone down over the years, and in each time, people talk and pundits and so forth talk about the impending collapse of the Saudi regime. But the reason I don't see that happening, and I'll explain it, is this. First of all, they have socked away a lot of money. That's the first thing. Second of all, what makes Saudi Arabia tick is the relations with the tribes and the family relations, and these are very well linked. You have 200 years of intermarriage between the Saudi royal family and all the heads of the tribes and the heads of the cities and regions and so forth. So a lot of the elite is linked by marriage. Now, on top of that, I'm going to add something else, is that these countries, the Gulf countries, not just Saudi Arabia, but the population is highly unpolitical. I mean, not that they're not interested in politics, but they don't, it's not part of their normal behavior to go out and demonstrate. This is not Iran, which has a long tradition of mass political activism. It's not Egypt, which has a long tradition of political activism. They just don't go into the streets to overthrow anything or to do anything. This doesn't mean, of course, you know, past behavior is no guarantee of future behavior, but it would take mass poverty or some horrible, horrible cataclysmic failure to really get people into the streets, and I don't see that happening. People also know that there are not many alternatives to the current regime, and alternatives could be worse. So I just don't see the regime collapsing, but I could be wrong.
Thank you.
It's now 2:25, and I'll ask the last question since there are no more questions in the queue. Oh, I see that one has come in. Ellen, would you like to address that?
Yes, I will. Please go ahead with your question when you hear your line has been unmuted.
Yes, hi. This is Jerry Stern calling in. I appreciate your very wise words, Professor Teitelbaum. My question is, recently Saudi Arabia announced a major purchase of Russian arms or Russian defense equipment, and I wanted to know if you think this is simply a reaction to America's détente with Iran and a dalliance with an opponent of the U.S., or whether it actually indicates a paradigm shift by Saudi Arabia towards Russia and towards a country that you know, that's really not part of the West, and would indicate a decline in its participation in markets. And particularly in the defense industry in the West?
Sure. Well, it's a great question. You know, defense relationships are hard to change abruptly. You know, it's kind of like they say an aircraft carrier takes a huge amount of time to make a turn, to make a 180-degree turn. Wedded to the U.S. defense relationship for many, many years, purchases, contract, maintenance contracts, basing, although there are not very many bases there anymore, but they're really very much connected to the U.S. defense industry. But I think they are sending a signal that the U.S. isn't the only defense industry in the area. The U.S. has made a lot of noises about the human rights violations, about rates of executions. Of course, Iran has a higher rate of execution, but the U.S. isn't saying that now. And they're signaling that there are other fish in the sea, okay? And that they're not entirely dependent on the United States. I don't think the paradigm shift is here yet, but it's a very strong signal. We know that the Saudis want to become independent regional actors. In a way, they want to model themselves after Israel in this respect, although they wouldn't admit it. In other words, Israel is an ally of the United States, but when Israel sees that it has to act, and either the United States isn't giving the green light or they see no reason to inform the United States ahead of time, they will act on their own, as they've done many, many times, and we all know the incidents. And the Saudis want to develop the military capability to project power in the region. They can do it now a little bit in Yemen, but that's really stuck, and they want to develop this capability, and they see it in their interest to diversify their supply. So I don't think the paradigm shift is there, but if I was a U.S. defense contractor, I would start to be a bit worried.
Thank you.
Okay, we're approaching 2:30, but there is one more question in the queue. Josh, do you have time to take that?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Ellen.
Thank you. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, it's Ken Abramowitz, and I had a quick question for you relative to reform within Islam and within Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia controls all these mosques around the world, feeding false narratives to their kids and preaching against the West. Is there any movement within Saudi Arabia to try to reform Islam? I don't expect it to adopt the Constitution and Bill of Rights, but to do something to reform and modernize Islam.
I don't think there's a movement to reform, as I think I understand for you to mean it. Certainly not to modernize Islam. What they, as far as it goes in Saudi Arabia, they talk about that Islam isn't terrorism. That terrorism is against Islam. That ISIS and Al Qaeda, these are against Islam. That one has to follow established leaders. But I don't see from Saudi Arabia kind of an alternative, ecumenical or tolerant form of Islam coming out of Saudi Arabia. It would be too radical a change for the government at this stage.
Okay, thank you.
Well, it's just past 2:30. We've reached the end of our time. The Middle East Forum would like to extend our thanks to Professor Teitelbaum for offering his comments today and to our board for their participation. This concludes the conference call.